विश्वनियामदेवाः भद्रं पश्येमार्षभिर्यजद्वाः स्थिरैरङ्गैस्तिष्ठुवागुंसष्ठिनूभिः यशेम देवहितं यदायुः स्वस्ति न इन्द्र वृद्धश्रवाः स्वस्ति नः पूषा विश्ववेदाः स्वस्ति नस्तारक्षो अरिष्टनेमिः स्वस्ति नो बृहस्पतिर्दधातु ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः।
Ay, ay, ay.
We did some of 43, but I'm going to go back to the 43 and
did we?
Mm-hmm. You don't have any notes for it?
42. Maybe we should
We started it,
but we didn't finish it. Dukkam sarvam anusmritya. Dukkam sarvam anusmritya. Kama bhogan nivartayet. Kama bhogan nivartayet. Ajam sarvam anusmritya. Ajam sarvam anusmritya. Jatam naiva tu pashyati. Jatam naiva tibhashati. Dukkam sarvam anusmritya kama bhogat nivartayet. Ajam sarvam anusmritya jatam naiva tibhashati. Okay. In the previous verses he's now talking about what really is what we call the upaya, right? The upaya is the means for attaining something. So here the upaya, what is the upaya for gaining knowledge, for gaining what we call nishtya jnanam or jnana nishtha? Jnana nishtha is often a term that we use. Jnana nishtha is going to gain jnana nishtha, clarity. Nishtha means clarity. And rootedness. Sometimes Swamiji used to say it's being rooted in this knowledge, right? Your mind is rooted in this knowledge. Nothing can pull it out like that. Then after some years, he stopped using rooted. He started using clarity. You have clarity. You're clear. There's no doubts. No doubts means there's nothing in the universe or nothing in your experience that shakes you or takes you away from your knowledge. It's clear to you. Knowledge, to understand also, just a little bit more clear on this. When we say you have knowledge of anything, whatever it is, for something to have knowledge of something, that knowledge is actually dependent on the vastu. The vastu means the thing itself. Like, for instance, if I am to have this knowledge of this computer, or just the perception of this computer, for it to be knowledge, it has to be true to the form of the computer, right? So it's dependent on the object. Knowledge is dependent on the object, not on the subject. The subject, the means of knowledge, could be something wrong with them. You know, like my eyes could be jaundiced. That's an example that they use in the Upanishads. Your eyes could be jaundiced, or they could be seeing double, right? Like seeing two moons. Then there's something wrong with the pramana, with the means of knowledge. But if the means of knowledge is appropriate, then the vritti, the jnana vritti, means the thought modification in the mind should match or be true to the object in terms of shared reality. Like if I hold up this cup, we're all seeing the cup. You know, we can say, oh, this is a white cup, and we can describe it, and it's a shared reality that we're all experiencing. So the knowledge is going to be, for it to be knowledge, it has to be true to the cup form. See what I mean? And so here, to gain self-knowledge, that means that my mind has to recognize my being as I am. Now, the being that I am is not an object for me to look at, right? Because then who's looking? I'm going to be the self of the looker, the self of the seer, the self of the one who has any emotions, the self of the body. All of these things are objectifiable. The body is, the sense organs are, the breath is, whatever we perceive, they're all objectifiable. But I can't objectify myself, because then who's the one doing the objectification? And so to gain self-knowledge, it's going to be a different methodology, a different type of pramana, different type of means of knowledge that we have to employ. So there's something different between gaining knowledge of myself and gaining knowledge of the world. If I'm getting knowledge of the world or what can be objectified, there's a subject-object relationship. I have to bring in a pramana, some sort of means of knowledge that will allow that thing which is not me, that is the subject, to be objectified. Right? Like I need my eyes to see that painting. I need a pramana that will allow me to have the experience that is of something that is not me. See what I mean? But I don't need anything to give me the experience of me, because I'm here. I'm already here. This is a huge thing, actually. I need to have a pramana, a means of knowledge, to give me the experience of something which is that I can be away from. Like, for instance, if I look at that painting, I need my eyes. Say I want to have what we call aparoksha jnanam, direct, immediate knowledge, experiential knowledge of that painting. Well, I have to have my eyes look at that painting so that I can have a vritti, a thought modification of the painting, so I can experience it. You see? Now, what do I need to do to experience myself? So I'm already here. As a conscious being, I don't even need the mind for that. I don't need the mind for consciousness. Conscious being illumines the mind. It itself is ever present. So just, this is so important. Just think about this. Whatever you do, wherever you go, you are there. Yeah, you're always there, no matter. It doesn't matter where you go. Whatever you think, whatever you feel, you are there. You, in fact, are the constant. If you weren't there, then those experiences are not available. They're not your experiences. But you are always there. Right? But you, always being there, are also not an object of knowledge to the mind. You're the self that illumines the mind. Right? You're the conscious being that is present to the mind. You're the conscious being which the mind enjoys, the very being, the very existence. You're the clay of the pot. So you're always there. It doesn't matter what the emotion is or what the perception is or what the thinking is or the intellection is. It makes no difference at all. You're the very center, the very me, the very one who is present to all of that changelessly. It's not like you have this type of thought and you're there and then you have this type of thought and that's somebody else. You know, you have this emotion, I'm having this emotion, and then this emotion comes, well, that's somebody else. No, it's never somebody else. It is always me. It is always me. And all of these things, all of these different feelings, different perceptions, different emotions, they all negate each other. The happy emotion is different than the sad emotion, is different than the agitated emotion. This perception is different than this perception. This memory is different from this memory, you see? So the vrittis, the thought modifications, are continually, they're in a swirl, they're continually changing. But they're all changing, that, you know, they all belong to me. I'm not changing. I have what we call a pratignya. Pratignya means I can say I had this thought, and then I had this thought, and then I had this thought. So I remain the constant. I don't think about it like this until we start to analyze it, but it just happens to be a fact. I felt like this, and I felt like this, I felt like this. I was a little girl, and then I was a little older, and then I became a teenager.
Yeah.
So this me that is always present, is totally taken for granted until you start asking the question, who am I question? Who is this one that is always here, that the mind is continually identifying with? All these changing thoughts are continually saying, I am this, I am this, I am this, I am this. I am happy, I am sad, I am young, I am old. Continuing, that's from the standpoint of the mind, but actually the me remains the constant. So what if you start recognizing that? Who is the one that's wearing all of these dresses? Now I need, once these questions come, I become start to become a mumukshu. Now I need to know. I want to know who I am. Until then, I didn't care. I just thought I knew. It's not that I didn't care. I just took it for granted. I'm this body, mind, sense, organs, person who's living here. But then you start to question. At some point, you start to question, well, who is this one who's wearing all of these different dresses? Now I need to gain knowledge of myself because I'm here, experientially me, present, but I don't know who I am. I know who I am experientially, me, right? It's not somebody else. But I don't know what I am. In reference to the body, mind, sense organs, who am I? In reference to the world, who am I? In reference to God, who am I? There's no context. I don't have a context for myself. I don't know if I am born when the body is born and die when the body dies. I would like to believe that there's a life after death, that I survive death, the death of the body. I would like to believe that. But these things I don't know. I know that I am. I know that I am a conscious being. How do you know that? How do I know it? Well, that's the bottom line. Because I can't say I don't exist and I can't say I'm not conscious. It is my experience of myself. Now, this is where it gets tricky here. The experience of myself is that I am, I exist, and I am conscious. Then what if I ask you, can you see that consciousness? What do you mean, see it? You mean as an object? Yeah, can you see it as an object? Like you can see this, and you can see this. Can you objectify it? No, I can't objectify it. How do you know it then? Well, because I am that. That's why we say that my being is self-evident. How do you know you exist? Can you see existence? No, I am. I don't need to see it. That's who I am. I exist. I don't know how long I exist for, but I exist. And I am conscious. I don't know if consciousness comes and goes, but as long as I am here, I am and I am conscious. It's not, I can't objectify it, but it is the bottom line, and I just don't know what this consciousness is. So now, I go to a teacher in the India. You go to a guru, you go to a teacher to ask this question. Who, and this is something we don't understand about this question, because we've had all kinds of notions come over to this country. But the question is very, very simple. It's very simple. Say I come to the teacher and I ask, who am I? I'm not talking about some big capital S self. I'm talking about this person that now is coming to you, I am, I exist, I am me. But who am I? Does this me that I am, does it survive death? You know. What is this me that I am? Do I survive death? What am I? Who am I? I'm talking about me, not somebody else, not a capital S, not a God in heaven. I want to know who I am and who I am in relationship to that God in heaven, if there is one, and who I am in relationship to this creation and who I am, this very personal me, who I am in relation to this body. See how personal the question is? It's not a question about who am I, the big capitalist self, some God up there, somebody. Who am I? It would be, who am I in relationship to that big capitalist? I want to know who I am. So it's a very grounded question, right? And so now an upaya is, as Gaudapada is using this word, it is the means for answering that question. The very what is the upaya for gaining self-knowledge, atma-jnanam? Atma-jnanam, knowledge of the self, which is moksha from the Mandukya Upanishad. The knowledge of the self is liberation. What does that mean? How does that happen? What is the upaya? How do I gain the self-knowledge? How do I do it? That's what they mean by upaya. Okay, so then he says, this upaya is really twofold. The upaya is vairagya, comprised of vairagya and abhyasa. Abhyasa. Okay? The vairagya, when we say vairagya, we're talking about the nature, the quality of mind. Vairagya has to do with the quality of mind. It's the culmination, in a sense, of what we call antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind. By purity of mind, again, that word, purity of mind, antakarana shuddhi, is so loaded. Mm-hmm. Like if you ever read Autobiography of a Yogi, which I did when I was about 17 or 18, now the movie's out on it, or any of these Eastern books or yogic books or whatever, this antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind, I think it gets a kind of a Christian bent to it in the West also, where it's like being a saint.
Holy.
You have to be a saint, you know. To reach sainthood is to have a pure mind. That's very Western, right? So now we're not using antakarana shuddhi like that. We're using antakarana shuddhi, purity of mind, in a much more grounded, in a much more grounded way. It means a mind that itself enjoys a certain shanti, a certain peace, a sense of peace. And really that sense of shanti or sense of peace comes about, is something that we gain naturally as we mature in terms of the assimilation of our experience, which allows us to place dharma before pleasure. That's how it begins. Dharma before pleasure. And if we place dharma before pleasure, we learn that through our experience in the world. Pleasure is short-lived, right? And it can never trump dharma. If we let pleasure trump dharma, there's so much pain in that pleasure that it's not worth it. It's like putting your hand in fire. And so we learn that pleasure is short-lived, and it should never be at the expense of dharma, because then it becomes way too painful. So what happens for us as we mature, and this is like placing your hand in fire, it's just simple assimilation of experience. We learn dharma first. Okay? But when dharma comes first, kind of the golden rule, if you want, what is dharma? Ahimsa, golden rule. When dharma comes first, we realize experientially that dharma itself gives a great happiness. Dharma is much longer lasting. It's not like pleasure. Dharma, and we have much more control over it. Dharma itself brings about shanti, and it's our choice. It's our discipline, right? And so we can choose to do dharma where we can't choose to have pleasure. You choose to have pleasure, but this person gets in the way, and that person gets away, and this thing gets in the way, and it ruins the pleasure all the time. So we don't have any control over it, really. We'd like to, but we don't. We have more control over dharma, and dharma itself gives a deeper sense of shanti, a deeper sense of being close to Bhagavan, of being in harmony with something sacred. But even when dharma becomes paramount and we gain a certain shanti, when we gain that shanti, there's something else we want to know. And we start wanting to know, well, who is God? Who is Bhagavan? What am I really doing here? Why am I here? You know, what is the truth of all of this? That's natural, because my mind has space. And it has a certain sense of the sacred, because it's quiet. Whenever your mind is quiet, it has a sense of the sacred. Like if you go and take a walk in nature, and it's beautiful and quiet. Like if we go to the farm, so we've done this in so many ways. You have a sense of the sacred because of the shanti. The beauty of nature or the beauty of music gives a sense of the sacred. And that sacred draws you to it. That sense of the sacred draws you to it. You want to be with it. You want to know it. You want to unite with it. You want to have union with it. That all comes about, really, as your mind, that's a natural inclination for the mind when the mind enjoys some shanti. Okay? Now, which comes about really through dharma. Now, when that happens, the mind is now, the pleasures and all of that don't mean that much. I don't care that much about it. I care more about dharma, and then I care more about the sacred. You know. And so then, when the mind is in tune like that, in that way, it's ready to listen. Because what it cares about now is what the Upanishads are talking about. Mm. So say, what you care about is that which is sacred, or that presence of Bhagavan, or that presence of the divine, or the very that deep nature of yourself. That's what you care about. Then you come to this knowledge, and your mind is ready for it. You have what we call vairagya. Vairagya means your mind has matured to such a degree just because of your assimilation of experience in the world. You've matured to such a degree that you're not being pulled out. Your mind isn't being pulled out, let me have this, let me have that, and let me do this, and let me do that. It's not being pulled out that way anymore. Because that those things are all too temporal. And any type of, the more that you cling to those type of things, the more miserable you are. It's just, that's experience, that's our experience. Cling tightly, more and more misery. You know, let your grasp loose a little bit, the more relaxed you can be. Move in toward dharma, the more relaxed, because your commitment is to dharma. Move in toward the sacred, then there's a longing. As you move toward the sacred, then you have longing. You have desire for the sacred. And so that, then the Upanishads are talking to you. So that vairagya, when we say is dispassion, it means, dispassion literally means, I have realized that these pleasures and whatnot, they cannot at all give me what I seek. They can't. I've realized it, and that gives me a vairagya. And if my mind continues to run out, but I've realized this, then that's what we call just habit. It's habitual. Because of lifetimes of running out. And so you just gently bring it home. Right? So that vairagya is one upaya, and we're going to be seeing now how to bring it home in terms of vairagya. So that upaya is for what we call antakarana shuddhi, which means the mind is more and more assimilated the facts. You know, so it's more and more going toward this, what I say, going toward the sacred, or going toward being itself. You know, wants to know that. Right? That's the vairagya, antakarana shuddhi. The other upaya is for jnanam, because you have vairagya, you want to know. You want self-knowledge. You want to know the truth. You want to know what this is. The upaya, the means for that, is called abhyasa. Abhyasa literally just means repetition. Repetition of what, though? So when we use abhyasa as a technical term, doing abhyasa, it means you continue to expose yourself to the pramana, to the means of knowledge. So the abhyasa is, for the Upanishad, is shravana, manana, nididhyasana. Shravana means you expose yourself to this teaching, to the pramana, as long as necessary. until your mind has that clarity. You do it again and again and again. You don't just come to class once and walk away like walking on water. It's not like that. You come, you see, you gain some clarity, and then there's some doubts that come. So with the shravana, when the teaching is taking place, you'll be clear, and then you're, well, what about this, and what about this, what about this? So then you kind of keep coming, you know, and you keep bringing up these questions in satsang until your vision is clear. And then there's another type of questioning that you do and do and do until you don't need to do it anymore. It's called manana. Shravana is becoming clear on what the Upanishads are seeing it. Manana is saying, yeah, but why couldn't it be like this? I know the Upanishads are saying this, but why couldn't it be like this? You see it at the time of teaching, but then doubts come. Couldn't it be like this also? That's manana. So your mind has to be engaged to so that it can understand. It's the mind the one that doesn't know, right? It knows experientially, I am, I exist. It has the experience of ananda. Ananda is the sacred. It knows that, but it comes and goes. Because it's coming and going, because the different types of vrittis in the mind go on changing. And so the vrittis in the mind, the thought modifications in the mind, are being confused with the self that is ever present. And so the mind has to understand everything. It has to know. It has to be engaged. The mind that has the ajnanam and the mind that's lost out here in maya, it's that mind's lost because it doesn't know where to go. It doesn't know what to do. It doesn't know how to solve this problem of becoming of gaining my wholeness back. So it's struggling, you know, thrashing about actually, trying to get home. That's what it's doing. It's trying to get home to the wholeness of your own being. And so shravana, manana, nididhyasana, which we did in class today in the morning when we do the contemplation. Nididhyasana means what I keep seeing at the time of teaching, to just allow my mind, bringing my mind home to it. Over and over again, just bringing the mind home. Meditation is really bringing the mind back to myself. Just bringing it back. That's what meditation is. Meditation, if the mind were just staying there in myself, that's what we call nirvikalpa samadhi. Right? Meditation is I bring the mind back to my being. I bring it back and I bring it back. Because it has literally lifetimes of only having this arena. It hasn't had someone to go back to. Because there's been what we call this mutual superimposition, where there's no differentiation between my being and the mind, and the mind is thrashing, and so it's creating sorrow for itself and hardship, you know, and it's wanting to find a safe refuge somewhere.
Yeah.
You know? And so once it comes to knowledge and it has enough vairagya to be available for knowledge, you know, still we have to bring the mind back and back and back, because it's only accustomed to going out. Just think about it. Think about it. If you think about the dream, if you're a dream character in the dream, what does that dream character know? It's going to try to figure everything out that it can within the world that it lives in. But the world that it lives in is the world of duality. Whether it's the world of duality for the world that it sees through its sense organs, or the world of duality that it sees internally. This thought, you know, and this inner travel and that inner travel. We're still traveling about searching for vrittis, experiences. Let me have an experience of the divine, and we're still looking at it for an experience. Let me have an experience of the sacred. But that's not really what I want. I want union with the sacred. And that's not what I want either, because union, I can dissociate again. Yeah, you want to be the sacred. You want to be the sacred because you are the sacred. That's who you are. That's your being. So here, he's giving now, in this verse, very succinctly, abhyasa and vairagya. Okay? So the first part, he says, the vairagya, dukkham sarvam anusmritya. keeping in mind, remembering that anusmritya means, anu means after. Remembering after, after being taught. Bringing to mind after being taught through the pramana, through the Upanishads, by the acharya, by the teacher. So being traditionally taught the means of knowledge in the form of the shastra, the Upanishads. So having gained this knowledge, then then what remember, you know, gain, what you've gained, having known through the teaching, what? Sarvam dukkham. All of this is nothing but dukkha. It's not dukkha at all. Unless you want it to be something it can't be. If you want this world, or this mind, or anything in duality, anything, whether it be internal or external, if you say, it has to be like this for me to be happy, it's dukkha. Because it's not going to do it for you. It'll do it for a moment. Like if you say, oh, my mind has to have just these kind of thoughts, pure thoughts. The mind can only, it has to have pure thoughts. If it just has pure thoughts, you know, then I can really be happy, you know. And so we have to try to hang on to the mind, control the mind, have pure thoughts, you know. That's not going to work. Because some other kind of thought's going to slip in there. So you're asking the mind, or you're asking the body, or you're asking the world to be in a way that it isn't. You know? The only thing that's pure is Brahman. The self is pure because it's non-dual. Right? It's not going to change on you. It is what it is, period. That's not true for the world. That's not true for the mind. That's not through Ishwara. Look at what goes on in the creation. It's everything. And so what if you say, in order for me to be an enlightened being, I can only have this type of thought. On the soul spectrum of thoughts that are available to you, and the whole spectrum of emotions that are available to human beings, the enlightened person only has these way over on this end. But none of these happen anymore. You know what? Yeah. Not true. I would say what is true, though, is that maybe the way the buddhi relates to the whole panorama of Ishwara that's presenting itself is with vairagya. Vairagya means, I can be with you as you are. Oh, mind, I can be with you as you are. I don't mind. I can be all people. I can be with you as you are. I don't mind. It is fine. Because I don't need you to be a particular way. Because essentially your being is the sacred. Your being is Brahman. Your being is my very self. And so I can let Maya be as it is. The one huge revelation for me was one time when Swamiji said, he was kind of talking like I'm talking right now. Of course, where do you think I get all these things? He said something like, what is this with all of having to have this thought or this thought? My mind has all kinds of funny thoughts. I don't mind at all. Why? What difference does it make? That you can only have this thought or that thought. Mind can have whatever thought it has. But what about you? You're not having thoughts. Your being isn't having thoughts. Your being is always exactly the same. The sacred or the ananda isn't subject to any change at all, and that is what's natural to it. What is natural to the mind is continual change, and it takes in so much input and it gives out so much input. But that doesn't matter, because whatever the thoughts are coming and going, it doesn't touch you. You're always the same as the very being of whatever thought is there. You're not becoming anything. But if you hook on to all of this having to be in a particular way, that's dukkha. There's only suffering in it, because you're asking for something that it can't give you. So remembering, based on anusmritya, remembering Remembering that based upon what you know, because now you've had this teaching, so based upon what you know, remembering that and remembering it, then what? Kama bogat nivartiyat. Pull your mind back from going after these kamas, these desired objects, as though desired objects means this. I need this to be happy. That's what we mean by desire. I need this to be happy. No, you don't. You don't. You really don't. But you need it to be unhappy. So you just understand, pull your mind back home. From all these experiences, you know, I need this kama. And kama means this desired object, this desire, this desire. Even, you can even go internally in this way. I wish it would have been like this, and I wish my life would have been like this, and I wish my mother would have been better. I wish my dad would have been more of a person to me. I wish he would have been kinder, you know. I wish I would have had more opportunities when I was young. This on and on and on and on. If I had had these better opportunities, I would have things better, would be better for me now. Those are all kamas. They're kamas, but...
That's interesting.
Yeah. They're still there. They're unresolved desires that you think are causing misery for you now, right? So those also, we think of desires only of, here, I need this and I need this. No. Think of all of the things that you're mourning.
Yeah.
Those are kamas, right? So you can also learn when you watch your mind going back into the past, it would creating that, it's Jiva Srishti, creating all of that, it would be better if it was like this, and I would be better if that would have happened. All of these regrets, unfulfilled desires, to, you know, nivartiyate, let them go. Pull your mind back from it.
Nivartiyate.
See, nivritti, we've got two words, pravritti and nivritti. Pravritti means I go toward. Nivritti means I retract, go away from. So this means for this nivartiyate, it's a potential. Bring your mind back away from that. Let it go. Let that go. Right? Bring in your knowledge. This is all dukkha. You're creating, your mind is creating dukkha here. Your mind is creating it. Creation's not creating it. Your mind is creating it. All of this, you know, it's just the dukkha soup. So you want to pull it back. Just pull it back. Then he says, so that's the vairagya. That's how you deal with it. And then the nididhyasana, the knowledge, the abhyasa, he says, ajam sarvam. Remember, based on the anusmritya, bring to mind, based upon what you know, what you've been taught, bring back this. All of this is ajam. All of this has never been born. All of it. It is only Brahman. Your dream has not been born. If you have a dream, it hasn't been born. It comes into manifestation. There's no birth there. It manifests and it withdraws. There's no birth. Nobody's been born here. There's only one thing. Do you have the dream? There's only one thing there that's Brahman, is consciousness. There's nothing other than consciousness. The subject, the dream character, and the object, and the relationship, it's all Brahman. It's all just consciousness. I am the self of the dream character. I'm the self of the dream action. I'm the self of the dream object that the dream character is relating to. And I'm the whole dream. There's only one thing there, just conscious being. The dream is Maya. Maya, we say, is mithya. Mithya means it has no being other than what is its adhishtana. The adhishtana is what is actually there, which is conscious being. And so all of this, you know, remember, this has not been born. This is not real in the sense of It's not real in the absolute sense. What is real here is Brahman, is my being. My being is what is actually here. How do you see that in terms of your experience? Well, if you just relax for a minute Now just notice, and this is very good for Nididhyasana, we have to slow things down and then you can see it. Later on, you just always see it. If I say, I am, okay, I exist, I am now talking about something which is my own being. So that's what we call a paroksha. It's self-evident, immediate for me. I am, I exist. Now that's my own experience. Now when I look out here with my eyes at this everything in this room, I say, and this all exists too. I exist, I am, and all of this is also, right? But now the amness, when you say I am, is something that's immediately experiential as being itself. But I'm not looking at it, I just am it. I'm not looking at being. Mm-hmm. And when I'm looking out at this body, I'm not looking at being. If I'm looking at my mind, I'm not looking at being. Being just is. My amness just is. Okay? It's not an objectifiable. Now when I'm looking out here, I'm not looking at being either. There is no looking at being. There is just being. Existence itself, amness itself. There's also no experience of amness and isness. There's only experience of amness. You can call it isness if you want. It doesn't make any difference. But I say amness because it's me, the consciousness. Now, you can't look at some amness or isness or arness. There is only amness, and the amness is not objectifiable, and everything enjoys it equally. This body is, this computer is, the rug is, the space is, all beings are, all experiences are, all emotions are. Every experience I have is, and every experience I have, every experience comes into being and goes out of being. Every experience. The being, the amness, never comes into being and goes out of being. All experiences come into being and go out of being, but being doesn't come into being and go out of being. Right? So everything I experience has a prior non-existence and a posterior non-existence, but when it's here, it enjoys me, my being. You can't look at being, you can just be being. But there's nothing that doesn't enjoy it. And that being is consciousness. Why? Because just like everything without exception in my experience enjoys being, it also enjoys knownness. Knownness is consciousness. It is, it is, it is, it is, it is, it is known, it is known, it is unknown. What's really amazing is when you think of it, your own experience right now, everything is known. There's not really a knower. Everything is known. Let me explain. Can I say the wall is known? The space is known? Right? The body is known? My sense organs are known? I can know my sense organs if they're working, they're known. My thoughts are known? My emotions are known? My memories are known? My knowledges and ignorances are known. My ahankara, the I notion, is known. I am known. Consciousness. Everything is known. So where's the knower? The knower is just an instrument for that we refer to, like the eyes of the knower in reference to the form. But in fact, everything is known. That's the satchit. So once you start recognizing this, and in Nididhyasana, in contemplation, you can slow everything down to see that. And then when you come out of that, you open your eyes and your ears and you're back in duality, but your being hasn't changed at all. That's why it's good in Nididhyasana, just sit with yourself, for the mind to have that viveka, to differentiate yourself. And he says, remember, seeing all this is unborn, when you recognize that, then, jatam na eva tu pushyati. What he says then is, for such a person who sees that, then there is no experience of duality. You don't see duality. It's more like saying, seeing duality, you don't see duality. I see all of these names and forms, all of these different thoughts, all of these different feelings, just the Maya itself. I see, all of that is I see, but I see it all as myself. There's only one thing here that is real. Like in the dream or the imagination, I see the whole imagination, all of its intricacies, you know, but it is only me. It is only me. I see myself. As I draw my mind back and I gain that vairagya so that my mind's not getting lost out here, without vairagya, your mind gets lost. You have to pull it back. When the mind is pulled back, then you see this is all just myself. So this is the upaya. Now, so we'll take two more classes to finish this. That's it. Doesn't matter. Okay. But so now let me just tell you what he's going to do now. This is what it is. This is the upaya, the vairagya, and then bringing in your knowledge. But because of the power of all of the samskaras, all of the prior experiences, the mind keeps getting pulled back out. And so he talks about now how to help that mind mature. How to train the mind as though, you know, to be with yourself. And there's four different what we call different obstructions that happen to the contemplative mind. One is called laya, where the mind can fall asleep. Some of you will always talk about this, but this is the source of it. One is laya, the mind in contemplation can become dull or fall asleep. Vikshepa, it can get pulled out into samsara, can become agitated and, you know, just pulled out this way and that way. It's called vikshepa, so laya, vikshepa. The other one is, third one is kshaya. Kshaya means things are coming up from underneath, from the unconscious, that need to be addressed.
The little ones?
We say the little ones. This thing's coming up from the unconscious, kshayas. And the other one is sukhamaswadhyaya, means the mind becomes a little absorbed, and so it's enjoying some ananda. Right, and so then that pulls you out of your contemplation. Oh wow, this is so nice! So you start looking out at the ananda vritti instead of just going internally. So he spends these last few verses now talking about just understanding these what we call pratibandhakas, these obstructions to just resolving the mind into your own being. The mind really. From Gaudapada's the tact he's taking in this Upanishad is that the Maya has no reality apart from Brahman, just like you wouldn't call the dream as something that that is not dependent on yourself. It's totally dependent on your being. And so you can pull the dream back, your imagination, and pull it back. And you do it all the time. In fact, you're a jnani. In terms to your imagination. So you're having imagination. You have jnana nishtha in reference to your imagination. You can go with it, you can be with it all along, a whole while, it's just you, and you can pull it back into yourself and just be with you. So that's how it should be here, in the sense, you can go along with it, you can participate in it, you can enjoy it, and you can pull it right back into your own being. And so he talks about it like that in these next few verses, you know, because he sees all of this as nothing but Maya, you know, and so you need to be able to just resolve it into yourself. And he gives, so he talks about these obstructions, and it's very beautiful. So we'll do it next couple of weeks.
There's no hurry.
Let's take a moment. swasti prajapya paripalayantam nyayena margena mahim mahishaha go brahmane vyashubhamastu nityam loka samasta sukhino pavantu kale varashatu parajanyaha prativesasya shalini desho yam shobarahitaha brahmana santu nirbhayaha om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha sarve santu niramayaha sarve bhadrani pashyantu ma kaschit dukkha bhag bhavet asato ma sadgamaya tamaso ma jyotirgamaya mrityorma amritangamaya om purnamadav purnamidam purnat purnamudachate purnasya purnamadaya purnameva vasishate om shanti 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 hari om shri gurubhyo namaha hari om. Online people and all of us, I'm going to send out a, I still haven't sent out our schedule, but just so everybody knows, Wednesday night, which is New Year's Eve, we'll, for those who want, can come over here at 7:30, and we'll chant, have a class and a meditation, a small class and meditation, and we'll chant in the New Year. So it'll be like from 7:30 to 12:30 on Wednesday night.
5 hours?
Yeah, it'll be beautiful. And then on Thursday, which is New Year's Day, we'll have our regular Gita class Thursday night on New Year's Day. And then we'll have our regular Saturday class and Sunday class. And then it looks like I'm going to India. But I'll send out a thing for that. What I want you to know is to please come on Wednesday. Wednesday night and chant in the New Year if you feel to do that. We'll be online also.
Can you come late or do you have to be right on time?
You can just do as you always do. Yeah. You can leave early too. You can leave whenever you can come when you want and leave when you want. But I'll be here for the whole time.
And dogs are allowed?
No, I can't.
We're not. Okay.
I can't do it to Tibby. She's not ready yet.
It's hard on her.
Yeah. You know what you're
gonna yeah. The Dakshinamurti. Stotra, you know, mantra. Om namo bhagavate dakshinamurtiye mahim shrimi dham prajnam pritcha swaha. And I'll teach what that means in case anybody might not know it. I'll also have copies of it for you.
Good.
But, yeah. So, I hope somebody's here. I know somebody, some people will be here. I know.
You know, this word, aja?
Ajam.
Ajam, mm-hmm. It means unborn, mm-hmm. And it always shocks my sensitivities, because how should I be taking that word? Because everywhere I look, I see birth, you know, I see change. It's born and it dies, and born and dies. And there's a different use of the word that doesn't just kind of, I don't get a mellow feeling about.
Well, everything that you perceive within duality is subject to birth and death, but then the question is, what is the self, the being of all of that? Because anything that is born and dies means it has non-existence on either side of it. But nothing can come from non-existence. So what is the bottom line of that process? Right, so what actually is? And what actually is something which is not an object in duality, which is the very self of duality, and there's only one thing that can be,
mm-hmm.
and that's you,
mm-hmm.
your being, consciousness. But that consciousness itself can't be an object in duality,
mm-hmm.
which means there's only one.
Mm-hmm.
There's many bodies, many minds, many sense organs, but there can't be many consciousnesses, because then consciousness itself would be an object in the world. And so this world that is born and dies has really only one being that itself is never born and never dies. Mm. It's not an object. Mm.
It's so it's a self. Description of Brahman. Every time I hear it, I should go to that.
You have to go to that because you can't go anywhere here.
Yeah.
Because here everything is born and dies.
So the shift should be in that direction.
What other direction could it be?
It can't be. I mean, there is nothing else.
There is nothing else.
But I would like to have my mind used. It can get used to that, right? So
that's why I knitted dhyasana.
Yeah.
Really helps.
Yeah.
You have to see it, you know. See it means recognize the fact. Mm-hmm. So otherwise, it's just in your mind, Olga.
I just feel like it's really easy for me to nullify the existence of the world, and in a sense, the sadhana when you walk through the world. And you kind of suck out existence out of everything and recognize it as your existence, or just simply say, this is not real, not real, not real. I mean, that happens fast and can be stable. And at some point I started doubting what's the ethics of it, whether the stance, whether the sadhana, it's dissociative, you know, in a sense. So you are shielded, you are numb.
It's only dissociative. It's dissociative if you make the world here and the self here. That's dissociative.
Right.
But it's not dissociative. Like, there's no dissociation between the pot and the clay. So we're talking about this. In fact, it's the opposite of that. Because you're talking about this entire creation as Ishvara, as a conscious being. So just how much care you have for your own body, mind, sense organs, right? Mm-hmm. You know? You can have for the whole creation. You know, so you see the whole creation as Ishvara. This body, mind, sense organs is part of Ishvara, not an inert creation and a conscious being walking around. That's the dissociation to me.
Yeah.
You're like this conscious, there's this conscious being and the rest of the world is inert. You know, that means I'm totally dissociated from the earth and from all of the living beings, all of the animals.
And the air.
And the air.
Yeah.
And the whole thing. Mm-hmm. Instead, I become someone whose heart is open to this. Mm-hmm. Your heart is pretty open usually to your own self. You know, I'm very open-hearted in reference to my own well-being. But what about being open-hearted to the whole?
So you open basically into compassion or empathy, the affective component.
The empathy becomes much different.
Mm. I have another question also. Is nitya or maya a causal?
Oh. Well, first of all, there's two things to understand. When we're talking about Maya, we're talking about this, what is responsible for this display of duality, the material. We call it Maya. But what is the order of reality of this display, this infinite display of the creation? The order of reality is what we call mitya. So mitya means that which is dependent on something else for its being. So this creation, maya, is mitya because it depends completely on Brahman for its being. So the pot is mitya. The clay is satyam. Right? Because the pot is 100% dependent on its being for on the clay. So if we say this maya, which is the material responsible for the display of duality, that its order of reality is mitya, right? Then there's really nothing here but Brahman. Like with a clay pot, there's nothing really there except the clay, but there's a pot. So you have to, what do you say about that pot when really there's only clay there? We say it's mitya. And what allows for the appearance of the pot is what we call maya. Because really, there's only clay there. So here, there's only one Brahman, conscious being. But which is the self that is actually here. But this Maya, you know, has Brahman for its being. That's why we say that its order of reality is mithya. So now when you say, is it acausal? It's acausal in this sense. Brahman is acausal because it's timeless. It's never gone through any type of change at all. You can say Maya is acausal because it's beginningless. If something's beginningless, there's no first cause. Okay, so in that way, it's acausal. In the other way, it's acausal because it's not really here. Mm-hmm. Like, would you say are the activities in the dream causal or acausal? Well, in a way, from within the dream, they're causal because they're cause-effect within the dream. But in the reality, because it's mithya, that what you call causal is really acausal because it's not really there. But the other way of taking acausal is because it's beginningless, there's no first cause. Does that make sense? Yeah. So two ways of looking at it. Brahman is timeless, so acausal. Maya is beginningless, so acausal.
So at one point you said, I can't look at isness or amness.
Uh-huh.
And then later, a little bit later, said, what you see is that all this is myself. And what came up for me with that is, so
what you
we
recognize.
Can't look at, like when we do Nididhyasana, we're not looking at Brahman, because you can't do that.
You're right.
We're recognizing that everything is Brahman. And that's why you would say it's self-knowledge, not self-seeing. We don't see the self. We know that we are the self.
Let me put this, just to make sure we're talking about the same thing. We don't see the self as an object. But because the self is consciousness, it is its own experience that doesn't require any duality. Because consciousness is self-luminous. So I don't need to bring in another consciousness to light up consciousness. It's like you don't need to, the example we use is with the sun, you don't need to bring in another sun to light up the sun. Because the sun is self-luminous. Within the context of that type of an example. So here, consciousness is its own experience. Right? So it's not something like it has no experience and you're just assuming that it's there.
Mm-hmm.
It's self-evident. Is that right? Is that what you're saying?
That's not what I was saying, but that's clearly right.
Yeah.
I mean, you saying
that's what
that,
you need to see.
That, yeah. So doing Nididhyasana is, it's the knowledge part that I said as far as it goes, but that's only part of it. It's also that knowing.
Your mind differentiates, the Maya mind differentiates itself from my being, which is self-evident. And it recognizes that the self-evident being, which I am, never wavers, can never change, absolutely cannot do that by its own nature. And the Maya mind recognizes that that is its very self. But that the mind is mithya. These words all start to make sense to the mind. Right? And it recognizes itself in relationship to its changeless being.
And that's more of a recognition.
It's a recognition.
A couple reasons. One is that we're always here.
Yeah.
And everywhere.
Yeah.
But also that we can't objectify who we are. So there's no way to... It's not the kind of experience like looking at something.
Right, that's right.
Because we can't objectify.
That's right.
It's just, it's kind of a knowing.
But it is its own experience. You are your own experience. Like, just look, you know, when you're meditating, you're actually withdrawing all of your sense organs, right? You're closing your eyes, relaxing your body, and your mind is then turning toward your own being. And then the mind can differentiate itself and its activities from the from its very being, which is absolutely motionless and absolutely self-evident and absolutely me. You know, the me that you've taken, that's what in this meditation I said, I actually like this kind of meditation, where you're sitting with your physical body, and you say, you know, I am this physical body. Because when you say that, there's no conflict, because this very well-known me gets to be the physical body that you've always taken it to be. But it's that me, that very me that is so personal, so you, and you're very familiar with it, that is the me that is Brahman. So then we go in a little bit to this me that is with the breath, this me that is within the thoughts. And then we just focus on just this, the very nature of your being. And that one, it has what we call anuvritti. The me that is the body is the me that is the breath, is the me that is the mind, is the me that is the me. That me is Brahman. That is the me that's the self of all beings. That's Ishwara.
That experience is, like you have described many times, a coming into the foreground of the self. But it's not a complete separation of the self from experience.
No.
The experience doesn't go away either. There's always some kind of experience. It's changing.
It's changing.
It's just a recognition of what is itself, a differentiation.
That's true. And that's how it always is in life when you're walking around or when you're thinking and all of that. Though when we do meditation, you're pulling the mind in and you're changing it by making it become much more quiet and much more focused itself just on its own being. And so the mind as though erases itself only in the sense that its content now is not of something else. The content of the mind is only the self.
Well, you told me last week to ask this question, and now seems like the perfect time. I'm supposed to ask again about vritti, palavyapti and vritti vyapti. I don't know if now is a good time for that.
It's a good time, because actually this whole time we were talking so much about palavyapti and vritti vyapti. Palavyapti, these are the ways I go about knowing. So in the world, there's a twofold process. The first is called palavyapti, means to pervade. The vritti vyapti, and then palavyapti. Vritti vyapti means the vritti pervades the object, the thought modification. Like say, for instance, through my eyes, my mind pervades the painting as though, right? So I get a thought modification of the painting through the sense of sight. Now I have a thought modification of the painting, so my mind has taken on that thought, that form of the painting. You know, or if I'm looking right at you now, my mind is taking on that form through my sense perception. And that vritti, thought modification that has been given to me through sense perception, is known. Now that is illumined by consciousness. That's the palavyapti. So it becomes an object of knowledge. First the vritti takes the form, and as it takes the form, it becomes known. Whereas if the mind doesn't take the vritti of something that's objectified, then it can't become known. So it requires these two functions. They happen simultaneously, but they both have to happen. My mind has to take the form of the object, and when it takes the form of the object, it is known. So vritti vyapti means taking the form of the object. Palavyapti means its knownness once it takes that form. See what I mean? And so now, for self-knowledge, it is different than that, because I am the consciousness that allows for the palavyapti. Palavyapti means for the knownness of that object. So now when the mind, say if we're doing Nididhyasana or in teaching, I'm taking you kind of on a little journey, step by step by step, to recognize your own being. Okay? So now when the mind recognizes it, the mind is now absorbed in the self. Like say now my mind, and that's vritti vyapti, now I'm looking at the painting, my mind takes the form of the painting. Now I'm handling this pramana, or we're doing Nididhyasana. Your mind now as though takes the form of the self. Right? Because the self is what it's focused on. Instead of being focused on the painting, or being focused on a thought or an emotion, It's focused on its own being. That's vritti-vyapti, right? But now that that's happened, there is no pala-vyapti because the self is already the only thing that's there. So there's nothing to illumine that is other than what is already self-evident as the self. So that's where it's different, because for the anything to be known in the world, you need the vritti-vyapti of it so that it can be illumined, right? Because if you don't bring in a vritti-vyapti, then there's nothing to illumine. But what about when the vritti-vyapti is of the self? Then you don't need any pala-vyapti because it's already happened. It's already the consciousness, which is now the subject of the very subject of the vritti, right, is not needed to illumine it because the consciousness is self-luminous. Do you understand?
No, it's funny because I understood this a couple months ago. But...
What part don't you understand?
I understand the intellectual form of it.
Yeah.
I haven't caught up in corresponding that to my experience.
Your experience.
That's cooking in there, but
think of it like this, because it's actually it's too simple in a way. Because we can try to make it complex and it isn't complex. It's almost ordinary in this sense that anything that's not me, I'm not going to have an experience of it. Unless I have a thought modification that I gain through some pramana or another in order to have a vritti. That's called vritti-vyapti. I have to have a vritti, a thought modification of whatever it is I'm going to know, or I can't know it. Like even with this painting, unless I'm looking at it, I'm not going to know, have an experience of it. Even if I look over here, I'm not having an experience of the painting now.
It's away.
It's away from me. I'm having an experience of this now. Now I'm having an experience of this. So I require, using the pramanas or using memory or whatever I have it available to me, the mind has to take a vritti, and then if it takes the vritti, then that vritti needs to be illumined by consciousness. Because the vritti is maya.
Right? Oh, I get it. Yeah. So you don't need a pala-vyapti with the self-knowledge because it's already illumined.
Okay. Yeah. It's illuminated.
Yeah, that was the missing thing. It's with the maya. The luminary is the self.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And then what happens?
Well, then that knowledge has taken place. It's just that you don't need a pala-vyapti because the self already is the conscious being. Whereas everything else is maya, the vritti itself is maya. If the object of the vritti is something in maya, then it requires consciousness to illumine it. But consciousness doesn't need anything to illumine it because it already is consciousness. It is its own experience.
Yeah. Well, then the mind's done its job, but it just doesn't just sit there. Then it pops back up. I mean,
that's right. But the thing is, the ajnanam, the ignorance, is removed because the problem is not the self-experience. The self-experience, the me experience, is ever-present. It's that the me experience, I don't mean experience as an object, I just mean the self-evident conscious being that is me, is ever-present as me. The problem is with the mind that takes itself to be me. And that means if the mind is happy, I'm happy. If the mind is sad, I'm sad. If the mind is smart, I'm smart. If the mind is stupid, I'm stupid. Whatever the qualities or characteristics of the mind are, those become me. Not from the standpoint of the self. The self does not have any running commentary here. It's just conscious being. But from the standpoint of the mind. And so when the mind makes this differentiation, that ajnanam, that self-ignorance, is gone.
Yeah.
And so when you come out of that, say you gain that knowledge and then that vritti goes away,
yeah,
it's taken, and when it goes away, it's taken the ignorance along with it. Because yourself has always been there, and it has always been free. It's never not been free. It's always been exactly as it is, but the mind is the one that has suffered the ignorance and so has always confused me with itself. And now when it gains knowledge, that confusion is gone. And so when the vritti goes, it doesn't matter because the ignorance is gone and you're still there without the mind having that ignorance.
What makes
I'm getting tired.
That, like, it would seem like the self, which, well, it's the lack of shanti that kind of distracts us from more.
Well, when you say lack, it's the lack of shanti, but the lack of shanti is caused by the lack of vairagya, which is caused by ignorance, which makes me search for my ananda out here in the world, you know, through pleasure or just through desire. Things light up. If I had this, I would be happy. And these are the things that take away the shanti. But what really takes away the shanti is the ignorance, self-ignorance, which allows me to project my ananda onto the world. Right?
So theoretically, not theoretically, but in fact, when the mind is absorbed in the self, the ignorance is removed by the teaching and by this resolution. When it comes back out into the world, it comes out ignorant. Free then, right?
More or less. Now, you have to be careful about that because you can have what's called jada samadhi, like say you have a nirvikalpa samadhi. It's not associated with any knowledge. Then that's just an experience that the mind has had. There's no removal of any ajnanam, there's just an experience. But with pramana, you're taken step by step by step to the actual understanding and recognition of something. Whereas say you took drugs or you just were doing pranayama or you had a non-dual experience. When the mind comes out of that non-dual experience, it thinks it was wonderful and everything, but it was just a non-dual experience that you want to have again. So it's not an understanding that has taken place through a pramana, through a means of knowledge, so that you know when you see it, you know what's happening. It's been taken step by step by step, the recognition of something. That's different. That's why these experiences are called jada. Inert means there's no, by inert what they mean is there's no knowledge involved. It's just an experience, you know. And you can say that experience is so real and so wonderful and so sacred, but it's gone. The ahankara is still with the mind.
Mm-hmm. You know, I wanted to ask you about the meaning of the word moksha. So moksha is liberation from the fear of death, right? From the idea of you'll annihilate at some point, or that your existence is finite.
The word moksha,
yeah.
Moksha just means liberation.
So liberation of what?
Well, like say if I say you are a mumukshu, you are someone who has a desire for liberation. Now, this word liberation, then you ask liberation from what? Then we have to add on something and say in the context of the Upanishad, it's liberation from ignorance, self-ignorance, but through the gain of self-knowledge.
I'm really sorry to ask this.
You can say liberation from fear, liberation from death, liberation from sorrow, liberation from suffering.
What about the cycle of youth and death and rebirth?
Well, that's all going to come up. That's all going to be part of it.
Is it a value in itself, the liberation from that cycle? Because when I think about it, I run into a contradiction. Okay, if you just simply die, there is no knowledge that carries forth, and whoever is born is not me, so it's, in a sense, it doesn't matter to me whether there is
It doesn't
liberation.
Matter to Brahman, to yourself, but it matters to the ignorant body, mind, sense organs.
But in terms of the cycle, see, the reason I'm asking is maybe not enough time now.
Oh, go ahead, I'll see. I can do a little bit more on crashing.
I just learned that the contents of Buddha's revelation was as following. First day he saw his own past lives. And second day he saw the past lives of all the beings.
Yeah.
And the third day he saw that there is an ultimate reality and how this cycle is happening against the ultimate reality, and what's the root cause, which is ignorance, which causes reincarnations. So then he became Buddha, the enlightened one.
Okay.
So the whole teaching is holding on this idea of reincarnation, of what they call the dependent origination. It's sort of like this ignorance which pushes you into the cycle of, you know, reincarnation,
yeah,
grasping, suffering, etc.
Mm-hmm.
And so, and when I was thinking about it, it's like there is this logical contradiction, because the one who dies doesn't reincarnate. I mean, theoretically, yes, there is some current of consciousness probably carrying from one life to the other. But in terms of my subjective experience, like this individuality goes into unconscious or dies completely, it's like when there is suffering, there is no death. When there is death, there is no suffering. So then it's like seems that this motivation of liberation from the cycle of death and rebirth as a motivation to get enlightened or realized is not really logically consistent. You know, and I'm struggling with it, because, I mean, I totally understand how this liberation from the fear of death and recognition of your true nature is a value within in the context of one's life, but how it is a value in terms of this cycle, you know. So, and there is no Buddhist teacher to whom I can ask this question.
Well, I think you're mixing up a little bit Buddhism and Vedanta. But,
yeah,
but what you're talking about is called Dwadasha Nidana. It means the 12 chain, cause effect chakra, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And it starts with Ajnanam, and then it goes down to the sense organs or Sparsha, and it goes through all of these 12 steps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that every jiva goes through the life, which then causes you to be born again, and then born again, and born again. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So he has this chain of causal links that a person goes through, any person goes through, and then it keeps going around and around and around. Okay, it's called the chakra, samsara chakra. Now, of this 12-fold chain, only 2 of them are helpful to breaking those causal links. One is the removal of ajnanam, which is gained through the meditation upon the Four Noble Truths. Four Noble Truths are dukkha. First one is dukkha, suffering. There is suffering. But he'll just, the Sanskrit is just dukkha. The second one is dukkha samudaya. There is a cause for that suffering. So first of all, you have to contemplate on the fact that in this world, this is Buddhism, okay? It's also true. But the way they deal with it is different than in Vedanta. But we'd say, okay, in this world, there is suffering. Second, dukkha samudaya. There is a cause for the suffering. Dukkha samudaya is a cause for the suffering. Then there is, it's dukkha nirodha. There is a cessation of suffering. And dukkha nirodha marga, there is a path for the cessation of that suffering. Those are the Four Noble Truths. That, and we have ajnanam, ignorance of those Four Noble Truths. And so that ignorance can be broken by contemplation upon the truth. And each one, I can't remember everything right now, but each one, there's a whole things to understand about each one of those, of the Four Noble Truths that need to be contemplated on and realized. So that's going to be a weak link. The other weak link has to do with clinging, non-clinging, to give up clinging. It's the vairagya. Because that also breaks that chain. And so you have these two links. The other links, they just have a life of their own. There's nothing you can do about them. These are the two weak links in the chain. And by concentrating on these two links, you can break this cycle of reincarnation and get off the bus, so to speak.
What's the feelings? Why get off the bus?
Because of suffering. Because there's suffering. All of this is suffering.
But one doesn't remember from life to life.
Well, you do remember from life to life, in a sense. It's the same jiva. Well, they look at it different. It is they don't look at it differently. They, in terms of reincarnation, they accept. But they look at how reincarnation takes place differently, because they don't accept a self. Even when you use the term an ultimate reality, you have to be careful when you say that, because that ultimate reality is not the self, there is no self. But what they mean when they say there is no self is this. This is complicated, I'm too tired to get into it. I'll just tell a couple more things. It's just my mind's gone, so I don't have the energy. What was I going to say? Just a minute, I'm going to get that back. What was I talking about?
How the Buddhists see.
No.
You're talking about reincarnation.
Oh, yeah, reincarnation. Yeah, this is the problem. They say there's it's an Atmavada, there is no self. But you have to remember that they only use what we, in Sanskrit, we call the vachyarta, the immediate meaning of the word. So when we use the word self, we mean this body, mind, sense organs. This. Well, we don't use the word self for anything else. Self means me, here. Mm-hmm. And so the Buddha will say, there is no such self. It's just like if you use the word chariot. That's his example. You use the word chariot. The word chariot, there's no chariot there. There's a wheel and then a bench and pieces of wood. Mm-hmm. Where's the chariot? It's only a concept. Like that, there is no such thing as self. Get over that. There's no such thing. But for us in the Vedanta, we say that the self, we agree, is not this body, mind, sense organs. This body, mind, sense organs is part of Maya. It's part of Ishwara. It's part of the whole, a part to a whole. But the reality of what the self that you had taken to be this actually is the one non-dual self of the whole creation. That's the what we call the lakshyartha, the implied meaning of the word self, where you only know the vachyartha, the immediate meaning of the word self. We're saying that self, that is you, is actually there, but it's a self of the whole creation. They don't do that, which means for them, you have to come upon some sort of an enlightenment which makes you recognize that there is a reality, a paramarthika satyam, which is different than this maya, and that this maya itself has no essence, where the paramarthika satyam has no name and form. But they don't bring the two together. You know, they'll say this has no essence, but the paramarthika, the absolute reality, has no name and form. That's Nagarjuna.
Okay, so what I'm understanding is that within that system of belief is logic. Is kind of completed in itself, and somehow.
Well, I would say even if they don't look at it as a belief, it's a practice. You have to think of it as it's a practice which is very practical, and just labeling things. Their only means of knowledge that they will accept are perception and inference. Anything else, you have nothing to say about. And so, based upon your experience, based upon perception and inference, there are certain ways of relating to this creation that will eliminate suffering.
Okay, and so, all right. Well, yeah, I think it's connecting in the sense that within that view, that cycle of incarnation is kind of logical and makes sense, and you are freeing yourself from it, and that works like in that system. But transitioning from Vedanta into that system and then back, then things stop making sense because there are just too many differences. I mean,
yeah, the thing is, if you can understand Vedanta thoroughly, you say the Vedantas are, you understand that,
mm-hmm.
and you have that vision,
mm-hmm.
then you can go over to Buddhism and don't try to make Buddhism Vedanta, mm-hmm. but then you can understand what Buddhism is doing. You have to understand the different pramanas that are being used. There is only one reality after all.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're dealing with it in a different way. You know. There's more to say, but I'm going to meet with somebody right now, so I don't want to go any later. We'll do it. We'll do more next week. I'll see you tomorrow too. That's great. I'm looking forward to it. Hi, Lisa. Hi, Anne. Hi, Belinda. Okay, so see some of you Wednesday and Thursday, I hope. If you come on Wednesday, you can bring a little treat or something. Because when you're chanting, you might want to have something. I'll have something here too. Okay. All right. Yeah, that'd be something hot cider, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. So the idea of reincarnation, mm-hmm. the Buddhists, it's not that.
There's not a soul.
And yet the Dalai Lama. It's the 14th Dalai Lama.
They believe in reincarnation. They just talk about it differently in terms of the. Flow of consciousness.
They do say that something does go from life to life, and they call it the word I've heard is mind stream.
Yes, stream, but...
But I think it's a lot like Sukshma Sharira. I don't think...
But it's very, very similar on one level, but on another level it's not. But experientially it's still, you're still reincarnation. Mm-hmm. But you can say even now, from this moment to this moment, there's a stream, there's a change. They look at consciousness itself as changing. They look at consciousness as an attribute of the mind. They call it vijnanam. They don't separate consciousness from perception, for instance. So there's a change of consciousness, and the change of consciousness continues to flow, and I can't do it anymore. I'm done. I'm done.
Thank you.
I'm done.